In these podcasts, I will be talking with people who share their stories of tragedy and of hope. I will be exploring mental health and well-being with workplace professionals and also with folk who have struggled to make sense of their own lives. My hope is that these shared experiences will remove the loneliness from those people who are convinced it is their fate to suffer alone. I'm Dave Thomas, and I've been a serving police officer for over 20 years. You are very welcome to join me on Walk the Talk. In this, in what will be the first podcast in a series of four, I will be looking at adverse childhood experiences, how they can lead to addiction, and for some, a pathway to prison. I'm going to be talking to individuals who have lost everything, yet remarkably use that experience to ultimately lead themselves to the life they never had. It's not easy though, and in this episode, I'll be talking to Jackie Moulton, whose own recovery is well documented. So join us now as she describes her work as a counsellor and sponsor, and we talk about the stigma of addiction and how she deconstructs years of trauma to get back to the inner self. Jackie Moulton, welcome to Walk the Talk. You're a return guest and very welcome. How are you today?
Thank you very much. I've had a lovely time with you, Bev and Elfie, exploring Thursley and doing some interesting interviews with some interesting guests.
I know we've spoken previously about your own recovery and part of the series of podcasts this time round is about adverse childhood experiences, but perhaps just a little bit about how you got into counselling and being a sponsor for addicts.
When you do the 12-step program, you identify, you know, with somebody that you can identify with, a peer mentor, if you like, who's been around a lot longer than you have, in order to, you know, take you through the 12-step program. And the 12-step program is about a self-examination. So it's not about talking about what other people have done to you in your life, because that's what the addict feels and often projects outwardly. The process is healing yourself and looking at your part in your own addiction, how you've behaved, your thought processes, your distortion of thought, how you've managed your emotions and your subsequent behaviours. So it's, as they say in recovery, it's an inside job. And the addict previously will have sought validation externally from their primary drug of choice, alcohol or drugs or gambling or workaholism, sex addiction, but we're primarily talking about alcohol, in order to change the way that they feel. So you seek external values to change the way that you feel. And of course, that's never sustainable because they're external. The recovery process is to learn over a period of time how one validates oneself from the inside, that the validation comes from myself and not from anything outside of myself.
In the, I think, 16 years that you've been doing this work, what are some of the more typical adverse childhood experiences that that come to light?
I've been in a prison for 12 years, and I went to university and did a Master of Science in Addiction Psychology. And my experience in prison has shown me, because I've spoken to many, many prisoners in depth and explored with them their childhood. And without exception, each one of those prisoners has been mentally, physically or sexually abused in some way, that their life as a child is chaotic, unstructured, undisciplined, lack of love. And what happens to them is that is what we call in academic terms their authorial discourse. And the authorial discourse is, when you're young, you look to your parents to guide you And so it's author, your parents, discourse, what they tell you. And often they've been told that they're no good, they're of no value, they won't be any good to anybody else. I've had repeated examples of stepfathers in particular who have treated the child from a previous marriage in a completely separate way and a horrible, punishing way, as opposed to the other children within the family that he's had with the current wife. And so the stepchild, if you like, is over there. I've been terribly badly treated, often sexually abused by the stepfather, and treated in a way that is not part of the family. They're very, very sad stories. Now, I know, I can hear other people saying, oh, yes, there's other people come from dysfunctional families and they don't end up in prison and blah, blah, blah. And that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true that some don't, but some do. And we parent our children differently. So we might have four children and they will have all been parented differently, although by the same mum and dad, because of where people are within, you know, whether you're the eldest sibling or you're the youngest sibling. And what happens is that their emotional development becomes arrested at quite a young age, and then they grow into adulthood carrying the emotions and behaviours of a child.
You mentioned when we were talking earlier about over-emoters and under-emoters and how that is treated in therapy, and I found that very interesting. It was just...
Oh, what I observed in the recovery, for example, was that the addict is either an over-emoter or under-emoter. What I mean about that, they overfeel. So highly sensitive, overfeel, without applying any intellect to their feelings, because the feelings overwhelm them. Becomes a surge from the inside. They can't hold them. They can't manage them. They don't know how to apply intellect to them. And they act impulsively on those feelings, hence getting them into trouble in those circumstances within prison. Then there's the other type of person, in my experience, who is dissociated from their feelings. So they've learned at an early age to cut off. I remember one man who, when he was four, his father stabbed him under the eye. And the only time his father showed him any affection was when the father was drunk and would come home and wake him up and rock him and, oh, my boy, I love you, my boy. The rest of the time, he was a brute to him. A real brute. And this man learned to disassociate from his feelings. He didn't feel. And what he did, he used to feel. They used drugs in order to feel something. So the over-emoters often use or drink alcohol to numb the feeling, and the under-emoters, if you like, use in order to feel. And there was, and to be honest, it's not... For addicts, it's, there was, in my experience, it's not much in between. So we have to get them. I was an overfeeler. Now, that's a bit not very good if you're an overfeeler and you're a cop. And I was in the time in the police where you couldn't even, you could never show your feelings ever. So all mine were always kind of suppressed and bubbling underneath. And then when I left work, I'd have to have a drink because the feelings were too, you know, overwhelming. So I learned through the through recovery was to get in touch with my intellect. And that kind of became one of equal measure. My emotions are equal to my intellect because I feel my emotions. I then can apply my intellect and reasoning. Now, that does not cut me off. It just is much more a healthy process than being an over-emoter. And it's the same for the other people who, what they say in recovery is, you know, the good thing about recovery is you get your feelings back, and the bad thing about recovery is that you get your feelings back. And it is about how you get your feelings back and how you manage them in a much more constructive and mature way.
Part of therapy then, for, and I use that word loosely, some interesting models that we were talking through earlier, which I found quite fascinating.
So basically... for an example, which I've kind of touched briefly just now, was when a child's development is arrested, the feelings are repressed and there is a hurt child inside the adult. This child will then contaminate the adult behaviour because he's acting as a child within an adult body. So the work is to reclaim and heal the inner child so that it does not continue to contaminate, you know, the adult's life. And we use the word contaminate, taking from some work from John Bradshaw, who did enormous amounts of work himself, you know, very famous therapist and author. What he will say is that when our inner child is wounded, we feel empty and depressed, and life has a sense of unreality about it. We are there, but we're not in it. And this emptiness leads to loneliness. And because we are never who we really are, we're never truly present. And even if people admire and hang on to us, we feel alone. And when one is in chronic pain, all one can think of is himself, which makes often where they talk about the addict being, you know, self-centered. So we have to kind of deconstruct that in ways of taking them back to their childhood. And you can do that in a number of ways. But one of the ones that we take the word contaminate and we break it down. And each one of them, so C, for an example, stands for codependency, loss of identity, to being out of touch with one's feelings, needs and desires. So, for example, that's what I felt, loss of identity.
Yes.
When you're dealing with men in prison as well, is to look at their offender behaviours, which is where the once powerless wounded child becomes the offender adult. So you have to look at their offending. So I do a timeline on their offending background and their age, what type of offences they committed, and their drug and drink use. So you'll see the increase in drink or drug use, and you'll also see a correlation between their increase in offending. And so you start to bring their automatic responses, their unconscious, if you like, into their consciousness now and say, look, this has happened because of this. And then they start to see the picture and join the dots. One example is a guy who, in for murder, his father was an armed robber, and he was also the father in prison for murder. His father had a huge reputation on the estate. And he had this son, and the son, it was expected to be a thief. And he said to me, you know what, I'm not a thief. I'm not a thief. He said, but I had to survive on that estate under the identity of my father. Not his identity, his father's identity. And he said, so I was quite a big lad, so I learnt to fight. And he said, what I am really, Jackie, is a frightened little boy. That's who I am. I'm an adult and I'm a big man, but I'm a frightened little boy. And he said, and what I did was I learnt to fight. I had a reputation for violence, fighting my way out of it. I added drink and drugs, cocktail, to that violence, and I'm now here for murder. Now, that's one example of many. Another man who said, my father wanted me to be a boxer. But he said, I don't want to be a boxer. I wanted to be a footballer. That was my sport. But my dad had all his sons said, you'll be a footballer, you'll be a boxer, you'll be a cricketer. And these boys had to conform to their father's wishes when in actual fact there were none of those things. So what happens is we create what we call a false self. A mask, we put a mask on because we're not able to get in touch with our authentic self. So the work is to deconstruct the false ego that they've created and help them to get in touch with their authentic self. And they get scared, and they might. And one of them said to me, well, what happens if I find myself in touch with my, you know, I find my authentic self, Jackie, and I don't like myself. I said, it's impossible. That is your authentic self. You will like your authentic self. What you're fighting against is your mask. Yes. You have to deconstruct the mask. So we will look at those offender behaviours. We'll also look at their own kind of narcissistic disorders. So it's a long process, and we get them to write down and give each of these letters a heading accordingly. So N is for narcissistic disorders. We talk about that, and then they go away and they write about it in relation to themselves.
Yes.
So where did they get their sense of trust? Mm. How did they control? How did they act out? Magical thinking is a great one. So one of my, or magical beliefs, one of my men used to say, my house was totally chaotic, totally chaotic. I used to go on a bus, and I'd go around London on a bus all day, and I'd pick out families, walk in the streets, I'd pick out families that looked happy, mum and dad and children. And I used to go to the children's store in Regent Street, the famous children's store, and he said, and I'd say to myself, Hamleys, Hamleys. And I used to go into Hamleys, he said, and I used to say, I'd like to be in that family. I'd like to be in that family. Well, that's a lot, they look like a nice family. And this whole thing, and then he said, I'd have to go back to my own chaotic family. And then what he did, he could articulate about his feelings as a child, and then as an adult, he recreated with his own family the same destructive behaviour.
Yeah.
So you have to take them right back, see their patterns, their automatic thinking, and create new wiring in the brain. And that is a process that, you know, takes some time. It's painful. A lot of them talk about a sense of loss. Parents have left. That process as a child, certainly, you know, carry that pain. Lots have been about, you know, pain of loss. So it's creating an atmosphere, if you like, an environment that they can tell you how they truly like, truly feel, what happened to them, and help them in order to create new wiring within themselves and then reconstruct them to their authentic self. Now, that sounds quite easy, but it's quite hard because it's very painful, and there is a default setting in a lot of people that would say, well, do you know what? The default setting is too much easier than this. You also get, on the other side, people who are not in prison, you'll get, for example, adult child of alcoholics. So a lot of these are adult child of alcoholics, become addicts themselves. You'll also get adult child of alcoholics who don't drink, really don't like alcohol, but they'll go somewhere else. We'll go to work. Perfectionism. They'll say, I'm quite different to other people, but they haven't actually really thought about why they're different. The difference comes from being an adult child of an alcoholic, that they suppress anger. They've learned to suppress anger as a child because they've never been allowed to express it. They'll learn to suppress sadness as a child. Now, if you're a workaholic and perfectionism, you're going to get your praise, if you like, or validation from being that. And often adult child of alcoholics will be hugely successful people. Nothing wrong, absolutely nothing, you know, wrong with that. But they're acting out, you know, in different ways, which is completely different to the others because they've learnt skills in their adult child of an alcoholic compared to other kids who have ended up, you know, addicts themselves. So it's right across the board.
The one's destructive behaviour and the other sort of productive behaviour.
Productive behaviour, yeah. What will be the common denominator is that they will have, what you know, that void still. So however much you succeed, there will be a void that they can't actually put their finger on what that void is. But I've spoken many... for example, alcoholics who are adult child of an alcoholic will come into recovery and then start to think about their own kind of childhood as an adult child of an alcoholic, which allows them to forgive their own parents they'll go through that 12-step program. There is a 12-step program called Adult Child of an Alcoholic. So it gives them an understanding of where their parents were, instead of sometimes feeling quite resentful and bitter.
You've talked about adverse childhood experiences and how that person is, I suppose, frozen in time as a child. How do you unpick that and lead them into adulthood mentally and emotionally?
Part of the work I do is mask work, which examines the incongruence within them. You know, this, what I've spoken about, the false self and the real self. So they normally come out very, very similar, but with different descriptive words. So they might say, well, they're good, they're funny, they're a good listener, they're patient, they're perfectionist, they're reliable, they're loving, understanding, a family man, good parents, caring, want to help everybody on the one hand. And then on the other side, it will be, I'm impulsive, I know best, can't tell me anything, I'm fearful, I'm hateful, insecure, isolating, ruminating, won't ask for help, selfish, angry, lost, chaos, chaotic, upset. So there's an incongruence between them. Now, most, you could actually say, well, that's the shadow side of them. It is a shadow side that Carl Jung works. Now, with Carl Jung, he will say that we have to embrace our shadow side. We have to like our shadow side, in actual fact. Now, in a dysfunctional relationships, those shadow aspects of our personality have not helped them, not helped them in any way, shape or form, because they've ended up an addict, they've ended up in unhealthy relationships, they've ended up in prison, etc. So when you then do some mind mapping work with them and says, OK, what happens when you have not been dealing with your emotions? They will write things like, I feel resentful, I'm deceitful, I'm people-pleasing, I'm manipulative, I put on a mask, I have a lot of anger and I lash out, retreat into myself or isolate. It doesn't matter. But they know what happens to them when they're not dealing with their emotions. Emotion, emote. Energy in motion, that's what it means, energy in motion. And with the addict who overfeels, the energy in motion is too great and they feel overwhelmed and they lash out like a small child throws his toys out the pram. But he's a 30-year-old man and he's throwing his toys out the pram. He can't hold it within himself. So it's a matter about teaching them to hold, to surf the feelings, to feel the feelings, because they will pass, to go through that process. And you get them to look at their relationships, which they will describe as to you as unhealthy, because I've shouted at them, I'm demanding, I'm controlling, I'm inflexible, I've lied, I'm disrespectful, I threaten my partner, I'm uncaring and I'm not listening. And so then you actually said, what would a healthy relationship look like? And how do they manage their anxiety? Ways of managing, you know, their anxiety would be, you know, irrational thoughts, to be destructive, lashing out, self-medicating, distrustful. Self-harm is a big one as well. So all of those things. What would your life look like, you know, with healthy kind of relationships? And part of it is an integrating, you know, process that you ask them to do a feelings diary, which they need to fill in on a daily basis. What feeling came up, what was it about, what drove that feeling, and what happened. So you begin to make these very unconscious reactions and processes, automatic processes, conscious.
And that's
the difficult bit. So that's the bit. So another academic called John Barge talks about automaticity. Automaticity. We are automatons and we operate our life doing the same things every day and responding in the same way every day. And we don't actually look at our response and is it benefiting me? Because you could say, you know, alcoholics would say, you know, keep repeating the same mistakes each time with a different, expecting a different result. I expect a different result, but they don't actually do anything to change the result. So I could say, let's say you snapped at somebody and you'd say, I really shouldn't have done that. I really shouldn't have done that. But the next day you snap at the person again. Yeah. You're not changing anything, are you?
No.
And so you have to observe yourself. What was it? What was it that made me snap at that person? It's normally the same things that come up. You know, resentment, bitterness, fearfulness, ego, pride, lust. And what in the AA program we say, defects of character. Now, defect of character is something that does not work for me anymore. It doesn't work for me to be resentful. It doesn't work for me to be, you know, judgmental. And all those negative thought processes does not work for me anymore. And the addict out of recovery will build on it, and they'll go, yeah, I've got resentment against Joe Blocks, and you know, 3 weeks ago I saw him in a room and he never even spoke to me, and a month before that I saw him in the street. And they all build up out of proportion, thought distortions. And the next time you see that bloke, you say, oh, do you know what? I'm going to have a drink. It's madness, complete and utter madness, because it's all external. Where Joe may not have spoken to you because his dog's died.
Yes.
Now, the addict will take it back to themselves. So 10 people walk in a room, 9 people go, hello, Dave, how are you? Nice to see you. And the 10th one ignores you and you go, oh, I wonder what I've done to upset, you know, Fred.
Yeah.
And it will take it back to himself. That's what you really have to say. Stop. Let's have a look at that thought process. You're not even inquired how Fred is.
Yeah.
What's happened to Fred in his life? It's nothing about you.
Yeah.
So we have to take the self-centeredness of them. And so what we encourage them to do is to get out of self. Do something for somebody else. Don't think about yourself. Because as we went back to, it is that wounded child that we spoke about earlier on, you know, the child that's feeling there's a hurt child inside the adult. So it's a childlike response in an adult body.
And I suppose as well, when people are examining themselves, they're looking through that skewed lens. The very thing that's making them the way they are.
Exactly.
And that's why they need help from people like yourselves to bring them out themselves.
Because you say to them, is that true? What evidence is that true? And you have to kind of say, well, yes, it's true. Well, do you show me, almost like a police officer, you show me that evidence that says, what evidence is that? This thought process that you're having is distorted. It's not true. Your perception is distorted because of that inner child. And what happens is sometimes, you know, it's not all rosy in prison, let me tell you that. You know, sometimes you're doing this stuff, it will bring up very, very painful wounds. And, you know, and they'll project them onto you and have a go and can't hold it, and they'll, you know, what I always say, puke their process on you. It's not a very nice saying, but it tells you what it means. They puke their process and you cop it, and you have to learn to hold that. Absolutely learn to hold that. Now, a lot of them will say also through this process that they had a part to play in themselves when they were sexually abused as young boys. And you say, you have no part to play in that. So we'll strike it out, get my pen, and I put a line through it and said, you did not have a part to play in that because you're a child, it's a criminal offence, and they often have guilt and shame about it. So, and you also say to them, now, we go through this, what, let's say your character defects about things that have not worked for you, anger, judgmental, lust, bitterness, resentment. And then we say, now tell me what you like about yourself. What do you think about yourself? And most of the time, they can't think of one thing. So I say, no, I'm not leaving this room till you tell me what you like.
Yes.
What's good about you? Because I find you very kind, for example.
Yes.
And you just give them a few examples. And they struggle. Because they have been brought up in a world that says, you're no good, mate. Completely critical. I had one critical parent, and one supportive parent, funny enough. But a critical parent. And I find it quite harsh. And in a way, you then start to internalise that critic within yourself. And I don't like myself, or didn't like myself for doing that. So you learn those things. And it's the same for them in a sense of saying, what do you like about yourself? So is the shadow side of the Carl Jung work, if you like, now. What's the asset? What's the light bit about you? Mm. And so it gives them some installation of hope that they're not all bad, and there's a week before the next time you see them, because you have to, they have to go back into the prison system, back to themselves, left with their own thought processes, you know, and it's tough. Now, I know you've heard from ex people that I've worked with in prison who are now on the outs, and their journey. So they're better describe their journey than I can to you, but they had to really dig around in the dirt, and there's lots of people out there that can't do that. And why I love the prison work so much is that it's a real privilege to help people who are prepared to have that courage to dig around the dirt and to truly know themselves. Because my theory is, or my observation, I suppose, in life, across the board, is that there are many, many, many people who go to their dying day never knowing who they truly are.
Mm. Well, it's a massive topic, massively important, massively complex, and I think the work that you and others do are not only going to affect behaviours of people in this generation, but perhaps for behaviours of people yet to be born.
It's the breaking the cycle. Mm. So it's two things that breaking the cycle, or it's three things, helping them to validate themselves, and thirdly, it's crime prevention.
Mm. Well, once again, Jackie Morton, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.